We're very, very pleased to have on our campus with us Professor Dr. Fernando Segovia from Vanderbilt University Divinity School. A very, very fine scholar and a fine gentleman as well. I think you'll really appreciate hearing him. He was born in Havana, Cuba, and in 1961 he came to this country at the age of 13. He did his graduate work at Notre Dame University and wrote his dissertation under the supervision of Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza. After his graduation, he taught at Marquette University in Milwaukee from 1977 to 1984, and since 1984 has been professor of New Testament and Early Christian Literature at Vanderbilt. He has done a lot of work in the Gospel of John, and that's exactly what he'll be talking with you about this morning. But more and more he has been interested in hermeneutics, and especially as that is enlightened by the Hispanic American experience. He has a book coming out next year from Fortress Press entitled Exiles in Jerusalem Toward a Hispanic American Theology. So I present to you Fernando Segovia.
Morning to all of you. Pleasure for me to be here, and I thank you for the introduction. I am presently at work on a multi-volume commentary of the Gospel of John, and what I'm going to do is to give you the basic design of the Gospel that I will be following in that commentary. Let me preface the presentation as well by saying that I regard all texts, including biblical texts, as literary, rhetorical, and ideological products as a whole, each text as a whole. What I'm going to be doing in this particular lecture is to be examining the first two parts of that product, namely the literary and rhetorical aspects of the Gospel of John. I am not going to go into the ideological dimensions of the Gospel. So, the basic question concerns plot and the effects of the plot on readers, the implied readers of the Gospel. Now, plot in itself is not a self-evident concept, so it has to be examined as well in the light of critical theory. Let me just make some regards along these lines. The term plot in the critical literature may be understood in terms of three intersecting axes, of which one is may be regarded as primary, as the basic continuum for most uses of plot, while the other two are said to weave around it, intersecting the first axis here and there. These are the first three axes, and then at the three axes, and then at the end of the lecture, I will come back to these and place myself within that critical perspective. The primary axis or basic continuum within this three-dimensional matrix is identified as the particular to abstract axis. Towards one end of this axis, plot is taken to mean an outline or skeleton of the main events or incidents of a narrative, that is to say, a relatively detailed description which remains very close to the narrative itself, the kinds of things that are sold to high school and college students so they can pass exams, whatever they're called, I forget. But that's the basic conception behind that particular, well, the basic conception is to allow you to pass, actually, but that's the underlying conception of plot. Then, as one moves away from this particular end of the axis, a greater degree of abstraction is to be found, leading to a more or less pronounced content-form distinction. Such a distinction is less pronounced at an intermediate stage of abstraction, where plot is seen in terms of the overall arrangements of the incidents, or the relationship among incidents, or between each incident and the whole, and thus in terms of the pattern or geometry of the entire narrative. The distinction becomes much more pronounced towards the abstract end of the axis, where plot is understood not so much in terms of the incidents it organizes, but rather in terms of the mind that does the organizing, and consequently as a primary purpose of minds rather than narratives, ultimately yielding a limited classification or typology of plots. So one can go from the very concrete to the very abstract. A second axis is then described as the synchronic-diachronic axis. At the synchronic end of this axis, plot is seen as a synthetic or structural whole, a mythos, open to a kind of static analysis. Within such a whole, causal completion determines the overall sense of unity, and all parts serve the final end, which thus emerges as the very soul of the work itself. At the diachronic end of the axis, plot is seen as the process of causal completion, and the dynamic or sequential element of a narrative becomes the main focus of attention. As a result, plot is seen as the source of movement from beginnings, where anything can happen, to middles, where things become probable, to ends, where everything is necessary. As one moves from the synchronic to the diachronic end of the axis, the content-form distinction becomes once again increasingly pronounced. Narrative is seen more and more as a mass of subject matter that cannot move until the end or destination is known. Now, the third and final axis is characterized as the content-emotion axis. At the content end of this axis, plot is seen in terms of patterns of narrative, while at the emotion end, it is seen in terms of patterns of emotions. This axis is further described in terms of the common distinction drawn in the literature between plot and story. At the former end of the axis, plot becomes the arrangement and connection of the events according to the orderly sequence of presentation in the narrative. In other words, how the reader learns of the story. At the latter end of the axis, plot is seen as the organization of these events for maximum emotional effect and thematic interest. In other words, how the reader is affected by the story. The content-form distinction becomes increasingly pronounced once again from one end of the axis to the other. The sequence of events is seen more and more in terms of its emotional effects. Now, with this working notion of plot in the critical literature, let me then go into the plot of the fourth gospel as I see it, and then at the end I will come back and put myself in each one of these axes so that you see where I end up within the critical spectrum. By the way, what I will be arguing is not that this is the sole definitive and objective structure of the Gospel of John. I will be arguing that this is only my reading of the structure of the Gospel of John, which may in effect give rise to 100 such readings, and I will be perfectly happy with that. Many people would not, but I would be perfectly happy with that. I'm going to use 3 methodological criteria in coming to my own plot, concept of a plot in the gospel. Let me spell these out to you so that you know exactly where I'm coming from. The first has to do with issues of genre and generic conventions. To begin with, I believe that the fourth gospel does represent, and all the other gospels, does represent an example of ancient biography, and as such follows the basic conventions of ancient biographical writing. First of all, ancient biographies usually present a threefold structural framework: a beginning narrative of origins and youth, a central and extended narrative of the public life or career of the hero, and a concluding narrative of death and lasting significance. The narrative of origins and the narrative of death function therefore as a frame for the central division depicting the public life or career of the hero. This frame, however, is ultimately optional, so that either one or both of these outer divisions can be omitted from any one work, and in effect, the narrative of origins would be omitted from the Gospel of Mark. Secondly, ancient biographies generally present 2 different types of development: the chronological, which follows a historical or temporal approach to the public life of the hero, portraying the individual events of his career in order of occurrence, or the topical, which follows a systematic approach instead, arranging such events in terms of the various different aspects of the hero's character. So it could have five sections, let's say, one on prudence, one on courage, one on fortitude, whatever, and then within each section, several representative events that would show how the hero is indeed a strong person, and so on. A wise person, depending on the topic chosen. While the chronological type depicts the public life of a hero in terms of a succession of events that gradually lead to his high point or acme, his most productive and creative period, usually said to begin at age 40, I find this comforting nowadays, the topical type portrays the public life of the hero as if it were one continuous acme. The hero is the same from beginning to end. Usually with a child hero, or the hero as a child, already giving premonitions of what he, or never is she, until the 3rd, 4th century AD, of what he will be like later on. Not unlike the incident of Jesus in the temple in the Gospel of Luke. Finally, in keeping with ancient conceptions of the individual as dyadic, or group-oriented, and of personality as static, or unchanging, basically, ancient biographies also present a stylized view of the hero's character and career. That is, the hero is not a unique individual, as our biographies would portray a person, but rather as an example of a type, which type exhibits certain very characteristic traits or topoi and differs according to the individual in question. So, for example, kings, generals, poets, orators, philosophers. In the case of the philosopher type, increasingly regarded as a divine sage or holy man by the first century of the Common Era, these constitutive traits, or topoi, can be identified as follows. Wisdom, insight into human nature, concern for the welfare of his fellow human beings, desire to communicate wisdom, and an ascetic lifestyle. In addition, the philosopher type admits of two subtypes in terms of the degree of divinity attributed to the hero. And in antiquity, divinity was attributed in various degrees to various people. It wasn't just human or divine. There were a number of steps in between. The holy man as either a son of God or godlike. Again, very specific traits or topoi distinguish the former from the latter. The Son of God has divine parentage, is born of gods, miracle working, and misunderstanding by followers and enemies alike. No one understands his wisdom. On the whole, biographies of holy men were topical in nature, thus depicting their entire life as one continuous acme, or high point. In the light of these conventions, then, the portrayal of Jesus in the fourth gospel can be readily summarized as follows. All three divisions of the overall structural framework, a narrative of origins and youth, of the public life or career, and of death and lasting significance are present, though their precise demarcation is very much open to discussion and interpretation. The chronological type of development is followed, though in fact no distinction is made between the public life and the high point of Jesus, the acme of Jesus. And the type of a holy man is adopted, and more specifically the subtype of a holy man as a son of God. In addition to the five essential traits of godlike men, Jesus' life also includes divine parentage, miracle working, as well as a thorough misunderstanding by all, including his own circle of disciples. Both enemies and disciples have no idea what he's saying, for the most part. Now, the second criterion, then, has to do with matters of literary form. The fourth gospel has recourse, all four of them, canonical gospels, has recourse to a very common literary motif of ancient narrative, namely the journey or travel account. Beginning with the Homeric epic itself and the biblical writings, the journey or travel motif becomes a very important means of arranging the material in question at a macro-structural level, at the level of the whole work, ultimately functioning as a host form and thus encompassing a wide variety of different literary forms, such as miracles, wisdom sayings, pronouncement stories, and so on. But the travel narrative serves as a macro structure that puts all of these together in some sense, in some sort of meaningful arrangement. This journey or motif, travel motif, is used in a wide number of narrative forms, history, biography, and romance, and is ultimately developed by the Romans into first-person narrative. The picaresque, the mock journey, and autobiography itself with Augustine. In the Gospel, this journey or travel motif is developed in two rather different, though highly interrelated directions. On the one hand, the Word of God is portrayed from the very beginning of the Gospel as undertaking, at the bequest of God the Father himself, a mythological cosmic journey from the world of God to the world of human beings, ultimately becoming flesh as Jesus of Nazareth, and thus carrying out the mission of the Father in and to the world. Upon the completion of this mission, the Word of God returns from the world of human beings to the world of God. As such, this cosmic journey provides an overall framework for the plot of the Gospel. The biography of Jesus of Nazareth, Messiah and Son of God, is the biography of the Word of God made flesh in the world. On the other hand, as the Word of God made flesh in the world, Jesus of Nazareth is further portrayed throughout the Gospel as undertaking a series of geographical journeys in the course of his public life or ministry, thus continuing to carry out the mission of the Father in and to the world. With the completion of the last journey, the mission itself comes to an end and the return to the world of God takes place. So, within the overall framework of the mythological cosmic journey, these geographical journeys provide a further and much more concrete framework for the plot of the Gospel. The biography of Jesus of Nazareth, the Word of God made flesh in the world, entails a number of journeys in the world of human beings as well. Third criterion. Matters has to do with matters of literary style and technique. The fourth Gospel has recourse as well to a very common literary technique of ancient narrative, the use of patterns of recurrence or repetition. Again, beginning with the Homeric epic itself and the biblical writings, patterns of recurrence become very important indeed in arranging the material in question, both at a macrostructural and microstructural level. Accordingly, such patterns range from the very small to the very large, from large segments to repetitions of words in one sentence. In the fourth Gospel, not only does one encounter, for example, a very frequent recurrence of the journey motif in the Gospel, insofar as Jesus undertakes a wide number of geographical journeys throughout the course of his public life, but also a frequent recurrence of a similar series of events surrounding such journeys. So not only are the journeys repeated, but the same kinds of events are repeated surrounding these journeys, insofar as a cluster of subordinate motifs are also used repeatedly in the development of these journeys. Now, with those criteria in mind, let me then tell you how I see these criteria working themselves out in the fourth Gospel. And the outlines will be helpful, especially in the middle section. I believe the first major division of the Gospel consists of John 1, 1-18. That is to say, what has traditionally been referred to as the prologue of the Gospel. This is the narrative of origins, as I can see it. It provides the customary first and reliable glimpse into the character of the individual in question. But it's quite unusual here. On the one hand, it contains no standard account of Jesus' ancestors, birth, or youth. In fact, no information whatsoever of this kind is given at this point. That information will be spread out through the Gospel, but not at this point of the narrative. At several points, actually. On the other hand, for example, his mother will be referred to, his father will be referred to, his place of birth will be referred to, and so on. On the other hand, it goes well beyond the usual attribution of divine parentage granted to a son of God, and bestows on Jesus a very high degree of divinity indeed, He is introduced thereby as the very Word of God itself, though we're not told how the Word of God, that is, there is no narrative unit that tells us how the Word of God becomes Jesus. There is no birth as such. He just appears on the scene. By the way, there will be no narrative unit telling us how he went back to the other world either. There is no ascension scene in this gospel either. The narrative of origins reveals in full Jesus' status and role, his identity and mission as the Word of God. He who was in the beginning with God and was God, the only begotten Son of the Father and the only one who has seen the Father, reveals the Father and makes him known. The narrative of origins introduces as well an overall framework of a mythological cosmic journey to the story of Jesus that follows. As the Word of God made flesh, he came from the world of God into the world of human beings, which he himself had created in order to carry out his mission of revealing the Father. Finally, the narrative of origins also introduces both a fundamental dimension of conflict and a fundamental assurance of victory and vindication into the story of Jesus about to be told. In revealing the Father in and to the world, quite ironically, did not accept or believe in him, but rather opposed him and attempted to overcome him. However, the world did not succeed, and as a result, only those who did accept or believe in him were given the power to become the children of God, with a multitude of benefits such as status implies and entails. So from the very beginning, the reader is given a very reliable and secure glimpse into who Jesus is, what he's going to do, and will assure you as well that despite the overwhelming rejection he will face, things in the end will turn out all right. This is a good, reliable narrator who knows the story ahead of time. Now, the narrative of the public life, then, or the career. This is the longest part of the gospel, from 1:19, as you can see, through 17:26. From the very beginnings of John's witness concerning the one to come after him, through the prayer of Jesus to the Father at the conclusion of the farewell scene. As in the case of the narrative of origins, this narrative is also rather unusual. On the one hand, while biographies of holy men generally follow a topical rather than chronological development, the fourth gospel portrays Jesus as the Word of God in terms of a chronological type of presentation. To be sure, such a focus is readily understandable. As the Word of God made flesh in the world, the whole of Jesus' public ministry becomes his high point, his acme. On the other hand, when a chronological type of development is followed in biographical writing, the many events used to depict the course of the hero's public life, such as miracles, maxims, discourses, catalogs, and so on, are usually connected to one another by means of vague transitional notices of a chronological character, thus revealing the unchanging character of the hero in pastiche form. He did this, and then he did that, and then he did this, and then he did that. In the fourth gospel, however, the portrayal of Jesus' public life or career goes well beyond such an uncomplicated connection of largely unrelated events and reveals instead a much more complex and artistic use of such events, a much more sophisticated use of plot. Now, let's see what this plot entails. Pivotal, I believe, are four different journeys of Jesus to the city of Jerusalem, which again you can see marked in that outline. The last part of which, of the last journey that is, constitutes the narrative of death and lasting significance. I would argue, in effect, that a first structural pattern, or let me then go through the patterns. First pattern. A first structural pattern of the central division of the gospel can be discerned in three sections dealing with the relationship between Jesus and John, and you may glance at the outline there. 1:19 through 34, 3:22 through 36, and 10:40 to 42. Thus, while the first two sections concerning John the Baptist surround the first journey to Jerusalem, the last two provide a frame for the second and third such journeys. As such, the first three journeys of Jesus to Jerusalem are properly enclosed by the repeated witness of John. There is a first pattern of repetition, which is highly significant. Why? The importance of these sections as literary markers is clearly enhanced by the use of explicit cross-references within the sections. The latter sections point back to the first section explicitly, so that the reader is directed back to the first section on John the Baptist by the later sections on John the Baptist. So the three sections should be read with direct reference to one another. Their importance is further enhanced by their decreasing length. Notice that as the gospel develops, the sections on the Baptist have lesser and lesser length, with each section smaller than the one preceding it, reflecting thereby not only the expanding public life of Jesus, but also the declining public life of John, so well conveyed by John's own declaration of 330, "He must increase, I must decrease," and the narrative itself is reflecting that. In other words, by their very length, these three narrative sections show how, as the ministry of Jesus begins to unfold, the ministry of John comes to an end. The content also reflects a change, or this change. In 119 to 34, the first section, located in Bethany beyond the Jordan, prior to the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, John describes his own identity and mission, points forward to the figure of the one who is to come after him and who is greater than he, and identifies Jesus as such a one. So it looks forward and it points. In 322-36, in that second section, now situated in the countryside of Judea, after the first major thrust of Jesus' public life, and indeed occasioned by Jesus' own journey to and ministry in that area, John proceeds to describe his own identity and mission once again. Points to the appointed end of his mission in the light of Jesus' own expanding mission, and gives further witness concerning Jesus. Finally, in 1040-42, again, in Bethany beyond the Jordan, where we had started out, many who had heard John in that area are now portrayed as accepting his witness regarding Jesus as true, and hence as believing in Jesus. So, through the sequence provided by these three sections, the appointed expansion of Jesus' ministry in and to the world is directly or indirectly contrasted with the appointed end of John's own ministry, not only in terms of the narrative, but also in terms of the content of these sections. John himself is marking his own declining mission while pointing to Jesus' own ascending mission. Second pattern of repetition. Several journeys of Jesus to Galilee. Three such journeys in all, as you can see from the diagram. In direct contrast to the sections on John, each journey is developed in greater detail than the preceding one, thus reflecting the expanding mission of Jesus. The first journey takes place almost immediately after the first narrative section of John in Bethany beyond the Jordan, and forms an integral part of the initial gathering of the disciples. This first journey to Galilee, then, is seemingly motivated by Jesus' desire to expand the circle of his disciples. That is why, apparently, he goes into the territory of Galilee. The second journey, in chapter 4, follows immediately upon the second narrative section dealing with John, and is directly occasioned by Jesus' desire to avoid any type of encounter or confrontation with the Jewish authorities at this point. The third journey is directly motivated by a similar desire on Jesus' part to avoid open persecution at the hands of the Jews in Judea. After 7:9, Jesus visits Galilee no more. Now, a very definite progression can be seen in these journeys as well. The first is quite successful. Jesus gathers further disciples, and the confirmation and confirms the entire group's belief in Jesus in himself through his own first miraculous sign, the sign at Cana. The second appears to be, at first sight, very successful as well, with a very positive reception by the Galileans and the belief of an entire household in him as a result of a second miraculous sign. However, there is a prophetic note of rejection at this point that points the way to the third section. Jesus will find no honor in his own country. With a third journey, then, this prophecy of rejection in his own country comes true. Despite a third miraculous sign and further reaction of belief in him, the multiplication of the loaves, the many who had followed him in Galilee eventually reject and abandon him, with the sole exception of a group of disciples who are now called the 12 for the first time. In fact, even his own family rejects him as well. So, these repeated journeys of Jesus to Galilee are not just haphazardly arranged, but you can actually detect a progressive development. First, rather limited though proper belief. Second, massive though misguided belief, as well as limited though proper belief. Finally, even more massive belief at first, everybody follows him to the other side of the lake, followed by massive rejection, limited though proper belief, and further rejection by his own family. If you look then at what has happened in Galilee, who has followed Jesus? 12 people and a household, no one else, despite its very auspicious beginnings. Third pattern, then. Every journey to Galilee is followed by a journey to the city of Jerusalem. We have four such journeys. Once again, each journey is described in greater detail than the preceding one, thus reflecting once again the ever-expanding mission of Jesus. Let's look at the first three journeys first. Two more patterns can be immediately delineated. Each one is associated with the celebration of a Jewish feast in Jerusalem. Each one also follows immediately upon a corresponding journey to Galilee. The first one takes place during the Passover feast. The second takes place in chapter 5 on the occasion of an unidentified feast. And the third, from 7:10 to 10:39, begins during the Feast of Tabernacles and extends through the Feast of the Dedication. A third pattern can be further observed at work with regard to these journeys. Each journey, once again, leads to a negative reception of some sort in the city. In fact, as in the case of the Galilean journeys, a very definite progression can be observed. The more Jesus goes back to the city of Jerusalem, the more hostility and opposition he experiences in the city of Jerusalem. So in effect, the negative reception in question increases dramatically with each new journey. In the second journey, you have outright rejection of his message with several attempts to stone him. And in the third journey, again, several attempts to arrest him and further attempts on his life. This comment then, this progression, points to a fourth repetitive pattern. This reception in Jerusalem always leads Jesus to avoid further trouble and confrontation with the authorities by leaving the city and seeking safer territory elsewhere. When the situation gets hot, Jesus gets out of Jerusalem to safe territory. This happens after the first journey, when Jesus goes to where John is baptizing. Happens after the second journey, when Jesus goes to Galilee. And it happens after the third journey, when he once again goes to Galilee. So, allowing then for the recurring cycles. Now, the fourth and final journey. Many of these patterns can be observed at work, again, in the final journey, which begins with chapter 11 and goes right through the end of the Gospel. The final journey is introduced by the Lazarus cycle of events, involving a further pattern of repetition. Two different journeys to Bethany, a town quite close to Jerusalem itself, and thus quite close to the very source of open hostility, and the final journey extends from 12:11 through the end. The first journey to Bethany in 11 leads to rejection and hostility once again. Now in terms of a decision on the part of the Jerusalem authorities to put Jesus to death on account of the raising of Lazarus. As a result, Jesus withdraws once again to safe territory. Now to Ephraim. He goes no longer to Galilee. He now goes to the town of Ephraim. One verse, 11:54. The second journey to Bethany is motivated by the Feast of Passover. The journey again leads to rejection and hostility against Jesus. But at this point, no withdrawal to safer territory takes place. Because at this point, the hour of Jesus is about to begin, and so he decides to go into the city of Jerusalem itself. No longer will he continue to flee his death. He will now meet his death, his appointed end. This final journey begins with a portrayal of the public events surrounding his very entrance into the city, and then a long farewell scene, the largest narrative scene in the gospel, comprising four whole chapters, actually five whole chapters of the gospel. Now, that brings us to the end of the public section, the public life of Jesus, and into the narrative of Jesus' death and lasting significance. So, with the Lazarus cycle of events, the repeated visits to the immediate area of Jerusalem, and the further withdrawal of Jesus for safety, the final journey itself undergoes a dramatic increase in tension. The capture and death of Jesus at the hands of the ruling authorities of the world are at hand, and also the ruler of the world, the devil, is also at hand, just waiting for Jesus in the city of Jerusalem. So the dramatic tension is tremendously built up at this point. Jesus goes into Jerusalem. Five narrative sections can be readily identified here. While the first three sections depict the preparatory events, the last two focus on the death itself and its promised aftermath, the resurrection. The last section is also unusual, as the first two were. Though an apotheosis of the hero, translation of the hero to God, to the world above, and even appearances after death for a final farewell are by no means unknown, resurrection appearances certainly are. Through such appearances, the fundamental assurance of victory and vindication introduced in the narrative of origins comes true. Jesus has survived death at the hands of his enemies and can now return to the world of God, thus bringing the cosmic journey to a proper closure. The section reveals in a very unusual way the lasting significance of Jesus. In rising from the dead, his mission of revealing the Father is fully and triumphantly accomplished. His status and authority vis-a-vis the world and its rulers vindicated, and a successor, the Paraclete, is bestowed upon the disciples so that they in turn can proceed to undertake their own mission in and to the world. So the narrative of death brings the plot of the gospel to a very proper and effective end. First of all, the fundamental conflict between the Word of God and the world introduced in chapter 1 comes to a climax. The growing rejection and hostility of Jesus during the course of his public ministry, above all in the city of Jerusalem, where he spends most of his ministry, leads to his arrest, condemnation, and execution by the Jerusalem authorities, both Jewish and Gentile. Secondly, the fundamental assurance of victory and vindication also comes to a climax. The end of a conflict, despite all appearances to the contrary, is not at all a demise for Jesus. Such an end, on the one hand, forms part of the mission of revelation entrusted to him by the Father, and is followed by the resurrection appearances, demonstrating that the apparent demise is actually a triumph on his part, but only for those who can so perceive it. On the other hand, such an end also shows that the authority of the world and its rulers has been invalidated and subverted at a most fundamental level indeed. The world has been subverted by the world above, with all its rulers, Gentile or Jewish, and its ultimate ruler, the devil, Satan himself, completely subverted. What now rules is Jesus and God. Such is then the artistic layout of the gospel that I see. This would be the literary part of the enterprise. Now, why was this done? Let's go into the rhetorical part of the enterprise. Is it just for the sake of artistic beauty? I believe, in a sense, it is, but I think it also has other purposes as well. I will mention five of these. There's a strong didactic function at work here. The dominant motif of journeying allows Jesus, the Word of God, to engage in widespread and sustained teaching regarding the ways and values of God, his own status or identity as Word of God, and his role or mission in the world as entrusted to him by God. The more he travels, the more he can disseminate what he has come to teach. While the mythological cosmic journey firmly establishes his origins and provenance and his message, the repeated journeys in the world of human beings assure a widespread hearing and dissemination of such teaching, and hence a repeated exposition and continuous development of such a revelation. As a result, the implied readers of the gospel, those readers that the implied author had in mind as he wrote the gospel, are drawn into the community of believers, initiated, confirmed, or reinforced, as the case may be, as the children of God, not only by way of repetition and recapitulation, but also by way of expansion and intensification. The children of God are those who believe in Jesus and carry out his commands, and no one else. Second, a strong polemical function is present here as well. The journey allows Jesus, as the Word of God, to undertake a broad and sustained attack on the ways and values of the world at large, a world whose own ruler is ultimately and explicitly identified as Jesus himself. And I won't have time to do this, but this will be one of the elements that I would pursue then in an ideological analysis of this gospel. Do we really believe that this world is ruled by the evil one? Now, at times I come very close to that position, but do we want to hold that and preach that today? And if we don't, we will reject the Gospel of John, in part. So it raises enormous hermeneutical difficulties for today's preachers, such as you will be. Is this world really satanic? And is our only hope in the world above? Through his mythological cosmic journey from the world of God, Jesus introduces the ways and values of God into an unfriendly and hostile world, ruled by the demonic powers. Through his repeated journeys in the world, Jesus also proceeds to call into question and attack the fundamental ways and values of the world. Through his visits to Jerusalem and his recurrent teaching in the temple, Jesus further proceeds to do so at the very seat of power itself, and in the very presence of the world's immediate rulers. As such, the implied readers of the gospel are also systematically differentiated thereby from the world at large, its own immediate rulers, as well as its ultimate ruler, the devil himself. The community of believers, the children of God, should see itself as deeply estranged from and at odds with the world, the children of the devil. In fact, they have been taken out of the world and are no longer of the world. Third function, warning. The broad and sustained attack on the world provokes a very definite and sustained counterattack on the part of the world and its ruler, as one would expect. The journeys lead to mounting questioning and massive rejection on the part of the world. His repeated journeys to Jerusalem involve not only questioning and rejection, but also outright hostility and persecution, culminating in his betrayal, arrest, condemnation, and execution. His mythological journey comes to an end with a forced and cruel departure from the world by way of crucifixion. Consequently, the implied readers of the gospel are specifically warned thereby that an acceptance of the ways and values of God in the world implies and entails severe opposition from the world. pointed questioning, widespread rejection, active hostility, and perhaps even the loss of life itself. I often think of people like Schuller and Pat Robertson at this point. The community of believers, the children of God, should expect nothing but hatred and oppression in and from the world. Norman Vincent Peale, where are you? Alongside this warning function, I would further argue for a clear consolatory function. Despite such a reaction on the part of the world, the journey motif allows for a great deal of comforting and consolation. The repeated journeys do meet with some success in the world. There are those who do believe in him, who accept his claims and his teaching. In addition, such a response is accompanied throughout by a host of promises and rewards, culminating not only in with the designation of such believers as the new temple of God, as the new abiding place of God in the world. After all, no longer will there be worship in Samaria or in Jerusalem. The temple of God in the world is now the believer himself, the believer in Jesus, but also with a solemn assurance of their own abiding places in the house of God. In the house of my Father there are many rooms, and these are for you. For nobody else. These are for you. Similarly, the mythological journey comes to an end, does not come to an end with death at the hands of the world and its rulers, but rather gives way to resurrection and a glorious return to the world of God. Victory over the world and its rulers. As such, the implied readers of the gospel are further assured that an acceptance of the ways and values of God in the world implies and entails a very privileged position indeed while in the world, though you would never know it from the way the world reacts towards you. Ultimate victory over the world and an abiding union with God in the world above. So the children of God shall receive glory and honor, not only in the world of human beings, but also in the world of God. Last function. There's exhortation here. The repeated journeys show that the mission of the Father in and to the world must be undertaken as appointed, regardless of the consequences involved, despite sharp questioning, overwhelming rejection, and severe hostility. Similarly, the mythological journey shows that the mission must be carried out regardless of its appointed end, arrest, condemnation, and execution. Only through trials and defeat in the world can the teaching of God be properly disseminated and the mission properly accomplished. As a result, the implied readers of the gospel are urged thereby to carry on with their own mission in the world, regardless of dangers or consequences, in obedience to the plan of God and following the example of Jesus. The children of God must bear much and constant fruit, despite all adversities, if they wish to abide in the vine of Jesus. If they don't, the Father will cut them off. Now, this is then the second part, the purposes behind the artistic creation that I see in the fourth gospel. Again, I cannot go on to the ideological dimension, which would be the most interesting. It would be quite interesting as well. What is the overall conception, and how does this overall conception locate itself within, socially and politically, within the world itself? Let me then go back, by way of conclusion, to the first three axes that I mentioned, and locate myself. With regard to the first axis, the particular abstract, what do you stress? The particular events, one after the other, series of these events, or even more abstract than that. I place myself in the center with an emphasis on the pattern or geometry of the narrative, as you can see, summarized into sheets, though with no claims to a final and definitive reading in this regard. Secondly, with regard to the second axis, synchronic, diachronic. Do we look at the architecture, or do we see that architecture moving? I place myself tremendously towards the diachronic end, with an emphasis on the dynamic or sequential element of the narrative. Every journey leads to greater rejection, whether in Galilee or Jerusalem. You combine both, and Jesus gets more and more rejection as his ministry develops. With regard to the third axis, that is, the narrative patterns or the emotional effect of these narrative patterns on readers, I place myself in the center, with an emphasis on the correspondence between the patterns of the narrative and the patterns of emotional reaction, which I gave to you at the end, the five functions from the didactic through the consolatory. So the result is a reading of the plot that is comprehensive and coherent, both with regard to the overall arrangement of the incidents and the relationship among the incidents themselves. That incorporates and reflects a very definite sense of movement and development from beginning to middle to end, and that is quite mindful of the close connection between narrative organization and emotional effect, with the narrative as a strategic whole consisting of a complex variety of interrelated and interdependent functions. And it would be then, after laying out this literary, these literary dimensions, these rhetorical dimensions, and these ideological dimensions, which I did not go into, that I can properly enter into engagement with this text on the basis of my own position within this world of ours. So for me, in the end, what I have done to this text, I have to do to myself. I also have a narrative pattern. I have an artistic pattern. I have a rhetorical pattern. I present myself differently wherever I go, depending on the audience, and so on. And I also have an ideological pattern. And when these two come together, then, we have what I see as really good theology. A theology of the world, such as the one that John himself presented. Thank you very much.
We have about 10 minutes for any questioning. So, Tom.
And, you started at the end to answer a bit of my question. I wonder how the reader is involved in this process of literary criticism. That is, how does the outline you produce literarily reflect you as a reader? Or have you found it going in the text?
No. No, my position, I come from a reader response position, as well as others, but let's say within a reader response position, in which I do find things in the text, but I stress the subject. I do find things in the text. So in the end, this is my construction of the plot of the gospel, not my reconstruction of the plot of the gospel. This is my construction, but one which I must enter into, or one which I must do. Enter into so that I can properly engage with the text at a theological level. In a sense, ultimately, this is a dialogue with myself. But I have tried to make the text as other to me, as different from me as possible. But in the end, this is my reading. And that is why I would stress the possessive adjective there, the possessive pronoun. It is my reading. So I can allow for any variety of readings. Of the same text or of the same plot, of the plot of the gospel. So indeed, this is me.
Are you able to self-reflect then and see something in here?
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Yes. I'm an immigrant. Journey is basic to me. Journey is basic to me. And I'm also a stranger. You see. So there's bound to be identification with this Jesus who is a stranger, who remains a stranger, and the story of my own people, who are also strangers, who underwent a mission, and who are not very well liked where they presently are. You see, as a Hispanic American contingent. Yes, indeed. But you're anticipating about four articles down the line. I'm very conscious of that, and I want to pursue that. Yeah, thank you. By the way, one thing that does worry me about this is that this does presuppose learning on my part. And so this is not a hermeneutic that would be available to the people of God in general. You see, this worries me a great deal. Because reading is for all. But I am a very privileged reader. And how then do I convey this? And this is the fifth article then down the road. I'm not a minister, but pedagogically then, as an educator, which is how I conceive myself, how then do I get this method across to people to conscientize them? Despite the fact that it does demand, it makes certain demands of education upon people. This is a quandary with me. Thank you.
I was wondering, my brain is churning the way it always does, and I've been directly engaged by the speaker. I was looking to the five functions towards the end, and the liturgy was, the journey shows this function, the journey shows
yes.
this function. I was wondering if you were to say that it's the concept of the journey itself that produces these functions, because my present state of understanding of God, I wouldn't adopt the journey as an overall structural motif, but I would agree with every one of these functions.
Mm-hmm.
So, in one way, these come out of the journey as a journey.
Remember, the journey is a motif, and it's a macrostructural motif, so that within each journey, there are a number of elements, stories and elements comprised. So you could actually get at these dimensions outside the journeys as well. However, it is that macrostructural level of the journey that exemplifies these functions of the text in a very clear and precise way. But I think one could arrive at these without the dominant motif of the journey, that is, through the choice of another motif. And maybe could arrive at different functions of the text as well, quite radically different from these, which would make for an interesting conversation. Simply, what I mean to do by that is to, that's a good question, because mythological can be understood as a number of connotations and denotations as well. What I simply mean to do by that is to signify part of the ideological element of this gospel, that the world is two-tiered, with one tier consisting of spirit, and the other tier, the world below, consisting of flesh. So by mythological, I mean the journey from this one world to the other world, from the world that we cannot perceive, that flesh cannot perceive, to the world that flesh can perceive. That is all that I mean by mythological. That is, the creation within the text itself of a world other than that that human beings are accustomed to, or in which human beings live. That is what I mean by mythological. Part of the problem is that in this particular product, in this particular text, we have no account of the origins of the evil one. That is, we are told that the Word is the agent responsible for creation, but who is responsible for the agent of evil that is presented as the ruler of the world, we're never told. There is no reference to the origins, to demonology, in effect. Where does this entity or individual or whatever come from? So there's a difficulty there to begin with. So you do find two dimensions in tension here. God did indeed create the world through the Word. God does indeed love the world. The disciples are indeed asked to go into the world, not to withdraw from it, but into the world with their own mission. At the same time, the world, the fate of Jesus in that world, well, at the same time, the world is controlled by the evil one. The fate of the one whom God sends into the world, the creator of the world, is crucifixion at the hands of the evil one. And ultimately, the fate of those who believe in Jesus and belong to Jesus as they go out into the world in their own mission will be exactly the same. The world will hate you and will put you to death. So we have these two dimensions of the text standing side by side. I think if we had had an explanation of how the evil one came into existence and into such power, it would be very helpful indeed. Now, with regard to the second question, it is usual in antiquity to regard a town and a specific position or area within that town as the center of the world, the navel of the world. This claims were made in this regard for Delphi. Claims were made in this regard for Jerusalem. Claims were made in this regard throughout all of Mesoamerica by the Mayas or the Incas or so on. So the claims are quite common in antiquity, and Jerusalem would indeed be seen as the center of the world and the temple as the center within the center of the world. So for Jesus then to call the world into question makes it imperative to go to that center of the world in that tradition from which he comes. And he goes into Jerusalem and calls that center into question. In effect, I don't think he really gives you another center, because now the believers become the center of the world, according to, as part of the ideology of the text. It is the believers who have the Spirit of God in them, not any temple in any section of the Mediterranean, but whatever the believers are, there will Jesus and God be, along with the Paraclete. So it's a decentering, but a recentering. However, not geographically, but now personally. Rather interesting, actually.
Edward, 11:30, can you do this real quick?
Probably not.
Okay.
You can do it anyway.
Okay. I was fascinated as we were going through your outline here. You talked about four journeys to Jerusalem.
No.
And how they coincide with feasts at Jerusalem.
Yes.
First journey is Passover, last journey is
Passover.
Two minor journeys in between. In the sixth chapter of John's Gospel, we have the recurrent statement that the Passover of the Jews was near. And is this where Jesus is instituting his Passover, that not a chronological Passover, or that this was an actual feast of Jerusalem Passover, but that a Passover that is dislocated from the Jerusalem Passover, his Passover for his people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything is dislocated. Because see, now Jesus is the water that gives life. Jesus is the bread that gives life. Jesus is the vine. And just go down all the symbols. The whole centering now is upon the person of Jesus, which raises, again, enormous hermeneutical problems and theological problems for us and above all for you as ministers. Is this the view of the world that you will want to present as you develop your ministry, as you undertake your ministry? And I would add, be cautious, because what that view of the world has done in part is to annihilate most of the brown peoples of this world. It was with this view of the world that missionaries went into Africa and Latin America and Asia, destroying everything that those civilizations had in mind and observed and followed, so that they could be saved and follow Jesus. If that's the other side of the ideology of this text, I have enormous problems with that. Enormous problems. Do you see what I'm saying? Is this what you really want to preach? Because the consequences of these are already historical. And the consequences, just look around. The consequences have been the colonialism of the last 500 years. All the civilizations of the Americas lost. Books burned, temples thrown down. All of it idolatrous and devilish. And therefore to be destroyed. Is that the Christian message? Is that love of the world? You see? Do you see what this tension can do? Is that how you really want to love the world? That's why, in my tradition, for example, there's an apocryphal story of... I come from the Caribbean, where the indigenous people disappeared within the first 50 years. There were no more. And then blacks had to be imported. But there's a tradition of one of their chiefs who was killed. All the chiefs were killed, as you can imagine. All the royal houses killed immediately. You have to get at the top. So that you can control the subordinates. And there's a story of this particular chief, Atue, being burned at the stake, and the friar in front of him saying, "Convert and you'll be in the kingdom of heaven." And he asked him, "Are you going to be in the kingdom of heaven?" He says, "Yes, we will all be there." "Then I don't want to be in the kingdom of heaven." You see? There's also a very marvelous story, the Indians burning one of the missionaries. Alive, you know. And the missionary thinks to himself and says, "Now I can get out of this." And so he begins to say, the missionary knows that an eclipse is coming tomorrow, the following day, and tells the Indians, "If you let me live today, I will cause the sun to disappear tomorrow." And the Indians look at him and converse with one another and then come back and say, "The sun will disappear tomorrow and 2 years hence, and 4 years hence, on such and such a day, at such and such a time." And then they had a good feast. But the point is, again, the arrogance that such a message not necessarily can give way to, but can possibly give way to, and has given way to. And this is something for all ministers to, seems to me, to consider at a most fundamental level.
I think what you're saying, you know, is a caution, but that does not mean that we should change the gospel proclamation. The proclamation is true. Those that don't know Jesus Christ will go to hell. However, how we respond to that makes the difference. That doesn't mean we take and beat people until they say, "You love Jesus." We know that that's not Christian anyway. Although we may have Christians may have thought that in their mind, "We're doing this for Christ." That does not dishonor the proclamation. It just says that we are human and we cannot always do the things we should. I think that's what we have to make sure we don't do. Because when we start saying, "Well, look what we have done, therefore the proclamation's wrong," well, then we're totally off. But we can say, "Look at the proclamation. It is truth. We proclaim the truth. But let's change our mode of action."
And I would be suggesting a different theological path, and I understand yours, but I would be suggesting a different theological path, that proclamation is not limited to or circumscribed by what we call the Word of God. That proclamation of the gospel is much wider than that which many of us and many of our traditions have stuck to and for very good reasons as the truth. And therefore bringing then a theological engagement on the part of the Christian within his or her own tradition, calling into question and perhaps even rejecting a large part of that tradition as a Christian.
The question I have then is, what separates Christianity from all other religions?
That's a question for the history of religions. That is a question which can be answered from any religion on earth, and can also be answered from the point of view of the history of religions. And it's a question which I am not equipped to answer. I would have to spend the next year reading on that. My response is not a cop-out. It is a very complex question, and it is one that cannot be answered solely from within any religious tradition, because the answer will be biased to begin with.
I think there is a simple answer. I think the simple answer is that as for other religions shows man saving himself, the Christian religion says that only Christ can do.
Again, at that point, I wish there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims here to tell us how man is saved. As a matter of fact, what I would have to say, one of the things I'm really considering now at a theological level is, what does this whole concept of redemption and salvation mean to begin with? What does this mean? Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm doing so theologically within the Christian tradition. But what do these terms mean in this world of ours? I'm no longer sure, but I am within the Christian tradition.
Thanks very much for that.
Yes, thank you.
Excellent engagement here with a very fine presentation and some really tremendous questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
A little bit over time, but I think we can say we really enjoyed this.